So my guess is the next thing you're going to hear is some kind of music starting, depending on the... Oh! You know, that's so funny. I saw him look over and push the button. Is he really doing that?
I think we're getting used to this. Hey, everyone, it's Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the show where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, a time that we gather every week for our deep dive into a single topic that is of interest to us and usually to y'all, too.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, GameStop, we're over it. We were early to it, and now we're moving on, because I know, sort of. We are actually going to talk about a whole other hot thing in finance and stock market trading, SPACs. I'm going to give you a minute to say, bless you, because I know someone out there is making that joke right now. Someone always does. It is short for Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, and it's the hotness right now.
So hot. This year, last year, I guess, 2020 was a huge year for SPACs. Shaquille O'Neal did one. Paul Ryan's in the middle of one. Bill Ackman's one. I just saw the former CEO of Boeing, Dennis Muhlenberg, is going to do one. It is the be-all and end-all on Wall Street, let me tell you, even like beyond GameStop.
Yes. And yet, to be fair, kind of a piece, which is like hacking Wall Street, which I think we're going to get into a little bit in a minute. But to make us smart on SPACs, how they work, how this trend is related to the meme stock situation, if at all, Amrith Ramkumar, he's the markets reporter for the Wall Street Journal, just wrote a piece with the headline, When SPACs Attack.
No,
welcome
seriously?
To the program.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you so much for having
Amrith,
me.
You did or did not write your own headline here?
I definitely did not write my own headline on that one. And the bigger thing is also the illustration, which shows a bunch of blank checks attacking the stock exchange. I don't think most people could tell those were blank checks, but they still looked pretty cool. So
that's pretty funny.
That's amazing. I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up.
So am I. All right. So while we both look this article up, layman's terms, 45 seconds, SPACs, go.
A SPAC is a shell company, so it's a pool of cash. So again, it's just a pile of money. So investors put in that money, and the only purpose of the SPAC, also called a blank check company, because again, it's just money that's sitting there, is to acquire a private company and take it public. So a lot of startups have realized that this is an easy way to raise money and access public market investors. And basically, they get the SPAC's spot on the stock exchange after the merger goes through. And normally, the SPAC has 2 years to complete that deal, but lately, it only takes a few months, and then day traders and everyone else can start pouring money into it and pushing the stock price up and make the SPAC's creators rich and the earliest investors.
So to clarify one thing, the SPAC is already public? Like it's a blank check company that itself is public so that when it acquires a private company, the company is sort of automatically made public?
Exactly. And that's a really important point. So it's a blank check company. It's a pool of money that typically starts trading at $10 a share on a stock exchange. So everyday investors can put money into it. And because it's already a public company, the regulatory requirements are much softer if you're a startup basically trying to combine with a SPAC. So a big reason we're seeing this method of going public become so popular is that futuristic companies can say, we're going to make X amount of money in 2025, and they're allowed to do that because they're combining with an existing public company. And that's a lot different than a traditional IPO process where you have to have several years of actual financial statements and all this other stuff.
So granted that the IPO process can be a lot of paperwork and in some ways cumbersome, it seems perilous to play fast and loose with the rules that are ostensibly there to protect investors.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions about SPACs because there are now about 300 of them, and they're armed with more than $90 billion in cash chasing deals. And they're basically inflating the value of startups in all these hot sectors. And everyday investors could be left holding the bag if all of this stuff crumbles. So regulators have said they're looking at this stuff and trying to make disclosure is really clear. They're trying to make it clear, like, who gets money. There are a lot of unique incentive structures in SPACs as well, where the people who create the SPAC are, if it completes a deal, which it almost always does, they then get to buy 20% of the company for a very small amount of money and at a huge discount. There are also unique incentives for the first investors in the blank check company when it initially lists at typically $10 a share. So the hedge funds that first put money in, they can always get their $10 back plus interest. And the everyday investors who put money in at 11, 12, 13 recently, they're taking on a lot more risk. They might not get that money back. But lately, it hasn't mattered because all of the shares of SPACs are going up. All of the shares of the startups they combine with are going up. In the few examples of this going badly, the most prominent one is Nikola, which had a lot of issues that have been well-documented, and the founder had to resign, and a short seller targeted it. Nikola is still worth about $8 billion. It's way down from its peak last summer. But again, these things make the insiders very rich, and right now people are just happy to be a part of it.
Well, and so far it's worked out, but I mean, my understanding of the kind of origin of this was that it was a reaction to this sense that the IPO process is just too onerous for these Silicon Valley companies in particular. It's just like, it's too much work, it's too complicated, there's too much bureaucracy, and perhaps a little too much scrutiny on business plans that may or may not include ever making any money. Like, is this just a way to, you know, unleash a company on a public market without the level of scrutiny that an IPO is supposed to enable?
That's one of the reasons. Another big one is just that during the pandemic, the IPO market was hit hard and markets were historically volatile. So I think a lot of people realized that it's kind of nice to negotiate a merger basically behind closed doors, and then you're not as subjected to like investor sentiment and day-to-day trading volatility like you are in a normal IPO. And yeah, the regulatory differences are a huge point. We've seen a lot of like early stage companies, whether it's Virgin Galactic or DraftKings, they can get huge valuations in the public market, even though they don't make much money now. If you include all share classes, DraftKings was recently worth about $40 billion. Virgin Galactic, the space tourism company that's hardly making any money, is worth more than like $8 billion now. So that's a big part of it, is people in Silicon Valley have realized this. And I think that's the key driver here, is that SPACs have become ubiquitous. So Silicon Valley, Wall Street, everyday investors, everyone wants to be a part of this. And they've become cool now, which is such a big change. Just a few years ago, they were associated with frauds going back several decades and like investor losses, but now SPACs are cool. And as someone told me recently, like, if you don't have your own SPAC, you're nobody. And the fact that spans Silicon Valley, Wall Street again, like, you can see why it's become such a big thing. And there are also people like Chamath Palihapitiya, who's probably the most prominent person involved in SPACs. He's created six of them to date. He took Virgin Galactic public. He recently announced a deal to take Social Finance public. He has more than 1.2 million Twitter followers and counting. He's thrown himself into the GameStop frenzy, but he's developed this like cult-like following. Mm-hmm. So everyone wants the parabolic gains, and he and other founders can make several times their original investment in SPACs with little risk right now. So that's, again, like, people talk about a lot of factors. I want to be clear. The main reason everyone's doing this is because they're making boatloads of money.
All right, so right? Look. Does nobody read the papers? Do they not understand that part of the reason GameStop happened was because of behavior like this, and that this is doing nothing at all to disabuse anybody of the notion that Wall Street is rigged, it's only for the insiders, the rich get richer, and I can't pay my rent?
So that's such an interesting point, because I definitely agree with you, and I think a lot of people see that side of it. But when you talk to individual investors, like I have a lot recently, who put money into SPACs, they see it as a way to get in early with the hot companies of the future. It's basically the Tesla phenomenon on a much smaller level. So retail investors do not get to participate in a traditional right. IPO process at this stage. So you're definitely right. They're taking on way more risk, and if this stuff goes south, they'll be left holding the bag. A lot of them actually know that, and I think that's an important point to make too. I think we assume a lot of the time that day traders or individual investors don't quite understand the risks. A lot of the ones I've talked to are, they understand the mm-hmm. risks, but they're fine with it to get in early with, again, a hot company of the future that could mm-hmm. be tied to EVs, climate change, these other themes. And it's not just individual investors, like hedge funds and professionals are layering on risk in this trade and making a lot of money too. So I think it's just this crazy environment that we're in with ultra low interest rates, people stuck at home during a pandemic, and this money has to go somewhere that's being pumped into the economy. And a lot of it is going into SPACs right now. I mean, nearly five SPACs a day are being created. It's absolutely wild every day in 2021.
Why? You said that during the pandemic, the IPO market kind of dropped, but obviously the market to take companies public didn't. Like, why couldn't all these companies be going public through the traditional process? Why, just again, to put a really fine point on it, why are SPACs better?
So, like we discussed earlier, there are looser regulatory requirements. So if you're an early stage company, it's a lot easier to sell yourself to investors. You can also right. put out a splashy presentation on YouTube being like, we're going to make X amount of money in 2025 again. And you can draw people in on social media in much easier ways, in a way you can't in a normal IPO. And again,
and
a lot
don't.
Of this
And to
is,
be clear, like you can't go on a big roadshow and prove all of this. You don't have to go on a big roadshow and prove all of this to bankers. And to investors.
No,
you don't have to prove anything.
All you have to do is negotiate behind closed doors again with the SPAC. So if you're a startup, a lot of people have realized now, I'd rather, again, negotiate with a small group of people. We'll hammer out valuation, all of that stuff. And then you announce a deal. The stock almost always trades up if you're doing anything tied to EVs or something like that. And then mm-hmm. you make a lot of money. And then your valuation goes up. And then you access public markets. So, yeah, just the kind of life cycle of the SPAC and how frequently rumors start building too, like speculation. Like one of the SPACs I've written about recently, Churchill Capital 4, is Bloomberg News reported in mid-January they're in talks to merge with Lucid Motors. The stock has like more than doubled. Trading volumes are crazy on that report. So there's a lot of that also where once investors get a sense of who you're trying to merge with, they flock to the stock almost always. So that's another big reason I think that we're seeing this. And at the beginning of the pandemic, the IPO market was very disrupted. But I think you're kind of getting at a huge point, which is late last year, we saw the IPO market go crazy and companies like Airbnb go public through traditional IPOs and the stock goes up. And it's the same phenomenon. Again, people in the SPAC market love to point out that companies in traditional IPOs also are relatively early stage and get obscene valuations that might go down later. And that similarity kind of carries over. The regulatory differences, of course, and kind of all of that are what set SPACs apart in many ways.
So if I had a bunch of rich friends and I could figure out how to do the paperwork, I could do a SPAC, I could do a SPAC and get a couple $100 million and do this myself, right? I mean, it seems to me that what's happening is barriers to entry to the public markets are being lowered.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's what everyone is saying is a positive again. So they're saying we're giving everyday people access to earlier stage companies, and that's only a good thing. It's increasing the number of companies in public markets and, yeah, making them more accessible. So if you get bankers and lawyers to sign off on the paperwork, understand the structure, and you can get demand from investors, yeah, sure, why not if you're doing something? The numbers are just truly staggering. Like when you think about there are like more than 90 SPACs tied to technology out there hunting for companies. So basically, all of those companies are incentivized, again, to find startups and merge with them, even if the deal terms aren't that favorable, right, because the SPAC creators get paid, the bankers get paid, everyone gets paid once they reach a deal. That's like the key point. So yeah, it's become very common for just people with money to get involved with SPACs. You mentioned some of them at the top, Shaq, Paul Ryan, Gary Cohn, another, like there are so many. It's just like a common way. Joanna Coles, the former Cosmopolitan editor. Yeah,
oh man, I'm definitely just getting there. Are you kidding me?
I know, right? I was just saying, and I'm like, all right, make
we
me
should,
smart.
Oh my
SPAC.
God,
we
should start a SPAC.
Colbert style. Yeah, we should start see what we can. It's like leveling up from angel investor. Like
we could
angel
buy a
investor.
Beer company.
What is it? Wired and tired. Tired. Yeah. Angel investor. Wired.
Right,
SPAC.
Right.
Here, going back to some of the when and if this inevitably explodes, let's just say, for example, this doesn't continue to go perfectly forever. I know there's no reason to think so now, but let's just say.
Sure.
It seems to me that the fundamental question is, so it's totally fine with the SEC if a company goes public whose only goal is to sneak other companies into the party.
You raise an interesting point, and people are like kind of trying to anticipate what the new SEC chairman, Gary Gensler, will do. Last year, the former chairman, Jay Clayton, talked about looking at kind of disclosure requirements and how the ownership of SPAC creators is tied to the deals they do and the compensation and just making that super clear. But yeah, I think a lot of people are looking at regulatory changes as a big factor that could stop the party, because in this market environment, again, I can't emphasize how wild this is. Blank check companies list, they have no business, and then their share price rises. So the underlying value of money in this company is $10 a share, and it quickly rises to 11. Like the last 125 SPACs in a row have all risen on their first day of trading, 115 in a row or so on their first week of trading. So, yeah.
And like, this will never change.
At some point, you would think the party would stop. But again, like we saw Nikola, we saw Multiplan, a touted healthcare company that merged with a SPAC that was like a prominent SPAC set up by a former Citigroup executive, Michael Klein. And Multiplan also got attacked by a short seller, and the stock has fallen a lot. But these rare examples are not really stopping the party. And you mentioned last year was a record year. Like already this year, like 96 SPACs have raised more than $28 billion. So if you extrapolate that again, it's absolutely, absolutely wild.
So is this an indication that the IPO market, as it has existed for decades now, is broken and was ripe for disruption? Or is this just sort of Wall Street adapting and finding a less friction-filled way to do stuff?
I think it's the latter. A lot of people tell me that it's basically, SPACs are basically part of the menu now. So you've got a traditional IPO option, you've got a SPAC option, you've got like private equity, the other ways you can raise a bunch of money. And yeah, I think, again, the reason this is so popular now is so many investors and people are making so much money. I had one investor recently tell me he advertised to clients a 6% return from his strategy of investing early in SPACs, but because they did so well, he returned 20% last year. So you have a bunch of hedge funds and people just piling in saying, we're in the SPAC business. You have ETFs now. You have three ETFs to date, I believe, that hold SPACs exclusively and are focusing on this. So I think it's a bit of both. Like for a lot of futuristic companies, again, the traditional IPO process is super risky. So I think there were some areas of disruption, but it's remarkable that we've seen the traditional IPO market heal and SPACs still become so popular. And I think that goes to that inherent cool factor, again, where like everyone just wants a piece of the action.
Amrith Ramkumar is the markets reporter at the Journal. I'm talking about SPACs. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. I'm still trying to wrap my head around these things. It's just, it's so interesting.
I know we could go all day on this. It's so interesting.
Yeah, we definitely could.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We'll continue reading and looking at your awesome graphics. I get the blank check thing. Now I'm looking at it.
Awesome. That's great. Hopefully I can come back again. Thanks.
See ya.
Yes, definitely. Bye-bye. Thanks, Amrith. Take good care.
Yeah, this is going to end in tears. I'm telling you. It's going to end in tears. Something's going to
happen. What? No, everything just keeps going up forever.
That's right. where we are
in real time. In real time producing, Erica Phillips asks, isn't this actually how all these Chinese companies got on Wall Street related to the China Hustle, which was this 2017 documentary?
Door, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I was like, I don't know quite enough about this to ask it as a coherent question, but it does seem to be similar.
Yeah.
And now I have to go watch this documentary. Recommendation,
yeah,
everyone.
It's a good film. It's a really good doc. Really good doc. Okay.
So fascinating.
Send us your thoughts, your comments on SPACs or anything else you like, actually, that you hear on the pod. You can do that by sending us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We're coming back.
Now we're back.
Boom.
I mean, really, that's a, I'm just saying for podcast land, that's a good beat drop.
Yeah.
It is Time for the news fix.
Yeah. Yeah. So Gina
You're
Smiley.
You're still thinking about it, aren't you?
I kind of am. It's just, look, if I had rich friends, right, and I knew a couple of lawyers and bankers, I could do this.
Yep.
And we should, like, buy a beer company or something to see what happens. Freaking George Clooney made $1 billion on tequila. Why can't I make $250,000 on beer? Anyway, sorry. Idle musings. Gina Smilek in the New York Times, she's a Friday regular for us, had a really interesting piece on race and indirectly racism at the Federal Reserve, talking about how few black PhD economists there are throughout the whole system, not just the Fed in Washington, but at the regional banks. Super, super interesting, really discouraging. I recommend it to you highly, especially as the Federal Reserve gets into more now social policy issues, also, regular policy issues like climate change, which we've talked about. Fed's doing a lot of work on class and race in this economy, and Gina's article is kind of eye-opening. Suffice it to say that you can count them all on the fingers of, like, two hands, the number of black PhD economists at the Fed, you know?
That's fascinating. Yeah. And, it is impossible to fix a broken system if there's no representation.
Yeah. Really good piece.
Interesting. That's so interesting because I also just saw today a story about how the ACLU has, for the first time in its 101-year history, elected a black president.
Is that right?
The ACLU has never had, until now, Deborah Archer, a professor at New York University School of Law, a black president, which kind of blew my mind. I was like, I'm sorry, what?
So you know what's funny is you and I, white people, are sitting here going, what, really? And every black person listening to this is going, of course, where the hell have you been?
Like, no Sherlock.
Right.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I know.
Oh, man.
It's a process.
Wow.
I've gone in a totally different direction today.
Okay. Yeah.
Because the other thing that caught my eye this morning was that Uber has announced plans to buy the alcohol delivery company Drizzly for $1.1 billion in cash and stock. The Axios commentary is that this could represent a strategic departure for Uber in that Drizzly doesn't hire delivery drivers itself. It just provides the back-end infrastructure for local liquor stores to provide their own delivery service. My internal commentary was, seriously, do we have antitrust laws in this country? At what point does Uber just literally buy everything that delivers anything?
Yeah, yeah. Mine, when I saw this story today, was, wait, there's an alcohol delivery service?
Yeah, bro. I know. Actually, I feel like I keep meaning to mention it to you every Friday when you're
I
don't have any of this and I don't have any of that. And I'm like, don't you live in a world where Uber buys every delivery company? Everything can come to your house, friend.
Yeah, I should have known that.
Drizzly,
oh, man.
One Z.
All right, I'm going to have to go look that up. All right.
You could get weed gummies. Like, we live in California. You can get whatever you want.
I'm sorry,
they'll just come to your house.
Weed gummies?
Totally. Weed gummies. They're the hot new thing.
Off we go to the mailbag. Let's get out of here. Come on. I'm embarrassing myself.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
So great. All right. First, we have a voice memo on the topic of vaccination from Baji in Texas.
My dad got vaccinated yesterday in Corpus Christi, which is one of the areas hardest hit by the coronavirus last summer, and the ordeal really whipped the local authorities into shape. Now they are boasting one of the most successful vaccine rollouts in the country, and a big part of the strategy appears to be simplifying the logistics by doing a first-come, first-serve, by-group honor system approach. My dad camped out overnight in his Prius while police patrolled the line to keep everyone safe. He was registered at 7:30 a.m., received a shot at 9:30 a.m., and was observed for 15 minutes for allergic reactions. Then he was home by 10:15, and he couldn't be happier with the experience. Today, the city confirmed that they had administered all 5,000 doses that day, setting a new record. Meanwhile, my mother-in-law is also 1B and has been anxiously waiting on a list here in the Dallas area with no idea when she'll be getting her shot. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to hear her thoughts on Corpus's approach. Personally, I can see how the opportunity for abuse would make people uncomfortable, but I find the results very compelling and I see the logic of it. Thanks to you and the crew for all that you do. I love the show. Bye.
So look, I'm going to be the cynic here, shocking I know, and say there is no honor system with this vaccine stuff, right? That just, it doesn't work. You've got rich people paying $10,000 under the table to physicians and vaccine centers for shots. I just, in a lot of ways, this is bringing out the worst in human nature. And I hate to say that, but I think it's true.
Well, I think that that's partly why I like the system that Baji is describing here, which is like any system that you set up is going to be gamed.
Yep.
So make the system as simple as possible so that you can do the most good, knowing that it's going to be gamed at some level, right? Like, I think what one of the things that is clear has been happening in California is that we tried to make things pretty complicated for good reasons, right? We said, okay, we're going to try to figure out who's an essential worker and who's a teacher and who is a certain age, but also, you know, has a Venn diagram overlap with exposure. And all of that requires burdens of proof that makes the process go slower. All of that can be gamed and is being gamed. And so a system that basically says, okay, we're open for 1B today, drive on down. If you get 80% 1B, 20% cheaters, and 5,000 shots in arms,
you're gonna call that
and you just sort of keep it real simple, that's a win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tough to argue with that. I think that's really well taken, for sure. For sure.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a hard issue, right? And the logistics of it and the equity of it, it's really tough. It's really tough.
But Baji, I'm really happy for your dad.
Yeah, it's great. It's super
that's
cool.
That's great.
James in Tennessee sent us this.
I have been following Wall Street Bets for about a year now. And I wanted to say two things kind of in defense of Wall Street Bets. First, they are basically the QA department of Robinhood now, as they have repeatedly broken their algorithms, their mechanics, and one man even managed to get infinite leverage, as he described it, and show that Robinhood is a really trash app that no one should ever use and should be taken off the app store because it's garbage. Secondly, I think that Wall Street Bets has probably done more to show the truth of Kai's catchphrase that the stock market is not the economy more than Occupy Wall Street or the 2008 financial crisis or Margin Call or any or Wolf of Wall Street, any of those movies. I actually think that Wall Street Bets being insane probably helps that cause more. And finally, someone please show Kai some of the excellent and very fun memes that they have made, including featuring Jerome Powell and Money Printer Go Burr. Please, I just want to hear him react to that. Thank you.
I've seen them. I've seen the memes. I love them.
Can I submit that we actually don't listen to Kai react to them, that we make this like a special YouTube? Kai reacts to stonk memes, because I would watch the crap out of Kai reacts to stonk memes on YouTube.
Oh, man.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Also, I love this call, and it is totally true, because there's really an argument to be made that Wall Street Bets, especially with respect to Robinhood and revealing its shortcomings, it's like they're shorting. They're their own shorts, and they're exposing the weaknesses in the whole thing.
I think that's exactly
They've shorted
right,
the whole stock market.
Right, reputationally, right? I mean, the deal is that GameStop as a fraction of the market is infinitesimal, but what it has done to confidence and belief and trust is really, really substantive, and I think that's absolutely real, for sure.
Yep, that's a great voicemail. If you missed Economics on Tap on Friday, we suggested that someone come up with an idea for a stonk tale. There have been so many good ideas. And this one is from a former bartender, Elizabeth, in Buffalo, in voice memo form.
My version of the stonk tale is based on a French 75. So it's nostalgic, but with a modern twist. It's deceptively strong and has a few conflicting flavor profiles. And as soon as I heard Kimberly's idea for hedge clippings, my mind went to rosemary. But then I realized we could level up and use a shrub, which is pretty much a vinegary simple syrup and hopefully close enough to a hedge to make the metaphor work.
Oh, there you go.
So here it is, the stonk tail. Add 1.5 ounces of gin, 1 ounce of lemon shrub, and ice to a cocktail shaker, and give it a good shake. Then strain it into a glass, top it with about 2 ounces of Prosecco. Garnish with rosemary and a lemon twist, and enjoy. I hope you like it.
Spoken like a real bartender. No. That's kind of cool. That was
I
like
know,
a professional
right? It's
person,
amazing.
As opposed to us just saying, oh, yeah, let's have a beer and a cocktail and whatever.
I will say, my friend Sarah, who is not a professional bartender, but like the most interesting woman in the world, who just, she texted me and she was like, okay, here's the recipe. I think, she said, it should be whiskey-based because of Robin Hood and Nottingham, but it needs to be spicy and a little crazy. She says, I would infuse the whiskey with habanero, then maybe muddle it with a little sage, hedge clippings, then a splash of Mexican Coke for the populism aspect, and a squeeze of lime because that would just tie it all together with the spicy and the sweet.
That was pretty good. I like those.
I mean, they're all over Twitter. We may have to just put like a little compendium online.
God, we should.
I believe we have a digital producer who could... Sorry, Tony, just kidding. All right, we are going to leave you at long last with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
So we told you last week that 2 years ago, Amanda Gorman had answered the Make Me Smart question for her. She is, of course, the poet who performed her kind of amazing poem, and performed is exactly what she did, right? Because it was just a thing to watch and see at Biden's inauguration. She's also going to be doing a poem ahead of the Super Bowl this weekend. Here's what she said 2 years ago on this program.
Something that I thought I knew, but I actually learned more about, was I actually always thought of Frederick Douglass as this figure for literature and words and the power of understanding language, basically. And it wasn't until I dug further into his history that I actually discovered that Frederick Douglass was the most photographed man of his time. Frederick Douglass was very intentional with the photographs he took. Mm. It wasn't random that this man who had actually been born a slave ended up taking more photos than the president of the United States. He made sure to sit down for so many photographs because he understood he could serve as a counter image to the stereotype that had been created about Black Americans at the time. So, for example, if you look at his photographs, he's never smiling. It was because Frederick Douglass was very intentional with rejecting the idea of the happy, jolly, merry slave. And how I internalized that in my own poetry, how can I be intentional with the imagery that my language is creating? And how can I use that to counteract stereotypes? In my own life as a Black woman, I found that people often place me in the archetype of the angry Black woman. Which is why I so purposefully write poems that are instead about hope, so that I can directly challenge that stereotype that Black women are just wedded to fury.
Man, that's amazing, huh?
Yeah.
That's amazing, especially after the year that we had in this country last year after George Floyd. That was extraordinary. A super
and
quick
the poem
sidebar.
That she ended up reading.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Super quick sidebar. I don't know if anybody heard the interview that Steve Inskeep did with her on Morning Edition right before the inauguration, but she went into some depth about how she has had trouble in her life saying her R's, which you can hear in that thing from 2 years ago on this program. And then you heard her at the inauguration and it was pristine. It was amazing.
You barely heard it at all. I was saying the same exact thing. I was like, wow, she's worked hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Super cool.
What a remarkable person. Whatever she is doing, I will be tuning in for.
Yeah.
It's my new role in life. Yep.
All right, and with that, we're out of here on a Tuesday. Questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? Come to us in our email, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Better chance of getting on the air, seriously, if it's a voice memo. I'm just, saying.
It's true. We love them.
It's true.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our computerized producer. And Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker skill and researches the show while we're doing it. Thank God.
Oh, man. Drew Jostad engineered today. Garrett Lang is going to mix it later on. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Donna Tam is the senior producer of this year's podcast. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. There we go.
Bum, 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 bum. I guess I picked a bad, this is where I should like break it to everyone that I'm going to need some mock stonk tails because I'm doing dry February.
Are you?
Yep.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So, mock stonk tails. I'll put it out on Twitter.